and Daryl Dornack unexpectedly discharged. The rifle discharged as it was being unloaded. Daryl Dornack stated, and so testified consistently at the trial, that his hand was nowhere near the trigger at the time it discharged. He testified that it discharged as he was pushing up on the bolt in his attempt to unload the rifle. Suit was filed by Mike Altschlager against Remington Arms Company, Inc. on products liability restatement 402A grounds. The original pleadings also had negligence and breach of warranty grounds. At trial, the case was tried essentially on strict liability theories by Mike against Remington Arms Company, Inc. Remington tried Daryl Dornack and developed a theory during the trial that related to Daryl Dornack's conduct. At the time the case was submitted to the jury, a charge was prepared that contained, from the plaintiff's standpoint, contained only restatement 402A issues. There were no negligence issues or breach of implied warranty issues that went to the jury. Remington submitted, and the court submitted, two instructions on sole causation. One was a sole cause instruction. The other was a sole proximate cause instruction.
Did Remington make any argument that your client was negligent, or was it solely the third party not in the lawsuit?
There were allegations of contributory negligence against Mike Altschlager. There was an issue of contributory negligence submitted as to Mike Altschlager. The jury found that Mike was not contributory negligence, and that passed out of the case at that point with that jury finding. There's been no appeal from that finding, and so that is not in the case at this point.
Was it a Remington 700 ADL or BDL?
It was a Remington 700 ADL.
Was there any testimony that anyone had tampered with the sear?
No. The rifle was in near mint condition. There had been no alterations or changes or anything of that nature since it left the factory. And the evidence developed that there is a sear lift problem in the Remington Model 700s. Although for different reasons, there had also been a sear lift problem in the Model 600s. And of course, although not part of what this court is looking at the trial, the issue between admissibility of the Model 600 evidence in a Model 700 trial was one of the issues that the court dealt with and had to decide.
Left or right-handed bolt type chain?
Right-handed. For a right-handed shooter. The rifle was being unloaded at the time in admittedly an unusual manner, but it was testified to by Daryl Dornack as the manner in which he unloaded rifles. And that is that he laid the rifle down on the left side and proceeded to, with the heel of his hand, manipulate the bolt up, his intention being to manipulate it in the normal manner that you manipulate a bolt, and unchamber the rounds in that fashion. His testimony was that as he, with his left hand on the stock, as he pushed up with the heel of his right hand, and had just begun the travel on the bolt, that the rifle fired. And that the heel of his hand being on the bolt, no part of either hand was near the trigger. The discovery and the testimony at the trial is that this is a possible scenario in these rifles if certain internal mechanisms are set up in the rifle having to do with sear lift and the relationship between the sear and other components of the rifle. Whether those components had been set up and manipulated in this particular rifle was one of the issues at the trial. Focusing though on the sole cause issue, then it was objected to in proper form by plaintiff's counsel and court submitted it anyway. Specific reference in the objections to the charge were made to the Roper case, which in our view is the determinative case in Alschlager. Interestingly enough, and to show the harm of having submitted that sole cause instruction, the jury came back not only finding no liability on the liability issues, but also finding that despite this man who had, if you'll pardon the slight overstatement, had virtually had his right leg blown off in the accident. It was amputated later, but the damage was so severe that they could not save it. Despite that, the jury found zero physical pain or mental anguish. Didn't hurt, according to this jury. No disfigurement. Here's a man who has lost his right leg above the knee, but he's not disfigured, according to this jury. No physical impairment, despite the loss of his right leg. This is indicative of the effect of an improper sole charge instruction on a jury, and it is exactly the type of problem that this court in Roper sought to prevent. Now, there is a consistent thread from the rulings of this court, beginning with the Turner case, going through Fleshman against Guardino, through A. Ford and General Motors, and on into First National Bank against Roper, to not divert the attention of a jury from the design defect issues in a strict liability case. This thread is only part of the larger task that this court has undertaken, beginning with Mobil Chemical Company against Bell, to implement the Rule 277 changes beginning in 1973. That is to fashion a viable, workable system of submitting factual disputes to a jury that avoids the evils that had developed in the special issue submission system as we had had it since 1913 when it was initially adopted, thereby giving rise to the tremendously fragmented special issues which in the 50s and 60s and earlier we had struggled with to the point that the special issue submission system was virtually collapsing under its own weight, to avoid those evils without at the same time going back to the evils that had given rise to that had caused the demise of the general charge prior to 1913, which was a proliferation of instructions that weighted down the general charge to the point that it was almost impossible to get a correct charge. Now, in going along that path of fashioning a workable jury submission system, this court, beginning with Turner and on through the cases that I just listed, has fashioned the theory or developed the theory that in strict liability cases, only the product defect should be looked at the jury. Third-party conduct diverts the jury, as the court has stated in its opinions, from what the real issues are. This is not really limited only to products case. The same comment was made by Chief Justice Polk in the Lemus against Montez case, which was a negligence case, in which there was an extra instruction given, an attempt to nudge the jury. Now, if allowed to proliferate, what we will have is that every potential defense will be resurrected under the guise of an inferential rebuttal issue, and we will have the broad issued submission once again weighted down with the proliferation of instructions which may be correct statements of the law and may very well be raised by the evidence, but which over a period of time will once again make our broad issue submission as unworkable as the general charge became prior to 1913. Now, the issue in this case has been raised of whether Duncan affects Roper and whether Roper is still viable law in view of Duncan against Cessna. And that was the position adopted by the Court of Appeals. That is that since Roper was a pre-Duncan case that Duncan against Cessna, or Duncan 2, had in some manner changed Roper, and that Roper was no longer the law. A statement, I believe, was made that the policy remains, but the holding has expired, which I do not understand that statement. Roper continues to be good law. It has been referred to by this court in a number of cases, and as being continued to be good law. And there are several arguments that justify the theory in Roper. One, Duncan fashioned a comparative causation system which was intended to subsume all defenses under the guise or under the comparative causation issue that the court said was to be used in Duncan. Now, if we are to weight that comparative causation issue down with extraneous instructions such as sole cause, then next will be act of God, next will be unavoidable accident, next will be every imaginable potential defense which can be resurrected as an inferential rebuttal issue.
So your argument here, it seems slightly different than what I think I read in your brief. It's not that sole proximate cause is not a viable legal theory. It's merely that once we start putting these in the charges, the jury will lose sight of their essential purpose, and that sole proximate cause is something that you should and can argue to the jury in a final argument.
It's both. I do not mean to be abandoning the position taken in the brief, but I'm simply, in this argument, attempting to expand on it.
Okay.
Now, the argument that Duncan, in some manner, changed Roper, I think falls under its own weight simply because this court has, in fact, cited Roper as being good law consistently. And the policy reasons remain the same. The policy reasons remain that the jury's attention must not be diverted from the issue, that is, the defective condition, if any, of the product, just as it must not be diverted from the issue which was involved in the Lemos case. And just as Justice Pope said in the Lemos case, the charge that is to be given to the court, to the jury, must not be weighted down with this proliferation of additional instructions.
Well, the cause is still an issue, even in the products.
Cause is an issue. Cause and fact.
So you're not saying that the jury shouldn't be charged on cause. Or that the defendant shouldn't be allowed to argue that this was not the cause because something else was the cause.
No, Justice Heck, we're not arguing that the defendant should be prohibited from arguing a theory that may be supported by the evidence. That would not be a viable position to take.
Your concern is, as a procedural matter, the judge ought not to encumber the charge with a lot of instructions that may or may not be correct law, but are just more than the jury needs to know.
That's correct.
While we're at it, would you explain why there are two instructions on sole cause? But I never did understand the theory of that.
Well, not having submitted the two instructions, I'm not certain that I know why they were there, except that we objected to both of them. One instruction was merely sole cause. The other instruction was attached to, in effect, the contributory negligence definition, the definition that went to the contributory negligence definition of proximate cause, which was just a standard proximate cause. And I would presume the defendants submitted both because they did have the proximate cause issue, which the proximate cause instruction, and then right after it, the sole proximate cause instruction. And that got into the charge because there was a contributory negligence issue as to Mike Walshlager.
Given your argument today, is there any case under current rules, so you would envision that sole proximate cause would be a proper charge for a judge to give?
That is a question that would take some thought to respond to.
Well, and maybe you can think about it between now and the rebuttal, because I gather you disagree with the court below when they said that if there was ever a case where sole proximate cause was viable, it would be this one, where we're talking about a third party who, at least according to the defendant, engaged in conduct solely unrelated to the way the gun was manufactured, which was the, at least under one argument, the sole cause of why your client got injured.
Well, my response to the court below, to that position by the court below, is that that is exactly the type of situation that should be proscribed by the Turner et al. Roper rules, because here the jury's attention was diverted to the conduct of a non-party.
But, I mean, that was part of the defense, not their only defense, we
right.
but part of it.
And
it's
so,
a legitimate one.
Yes.
And when, if ever, under our modern submission, should a defendant be able to highlight a potential defense by having an instruction about it in the charge?
At least this
potential defense.
Certainly.
Sole proximate cause, which
not
is something that can be argued by the negative from a proximate cause instruction.
I believe it would be improper to highlight in any case one particular theory of either prosecution or defense, which would tend to nudge the jury toward that defense. It is the process of highlighting that is the evil, and it should be avoided.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to.
Argument is a different issue, and the right to argue, whatever the evidence is not part of the plaintiff's position in this case. Merely what is going to go to the jury and the issue of highlighting one theory of recovery or defense. Yes, Your Honor.
In a typical cause instruction, the last sentence is something to the effect there may be more than one cause. Why doesn't that highlight that aspect of it, calling for a balancing instruction that says, in essence, and there may be only one?
Well, it's a question of how far you go. In the typical sentence that says there may be more than one cause, I think sets the outer limits. And I think that's what the court in Roper was saying, is that sets the outer limits. And there has to be a line, there has to be a limit, and then if you step over that line, you have to step over the line. And I believe that's what happens when you go the next step and give the sole cause instruction.
But why doesn't that, I'll just ask Judge Heck again, why doesn't that give a nudge to the plaintiff to argue that, well, they could accept what the defendant says, but the defendant's also at fault, too?
Because it doesn't highlight a plaintiff's theory. The fact that there could be more than one cause can be argued by either side. That is basically a neutral instruction. Granted, plaintiffs frequently argue there can be more than one cause, but the fact that there can be more than one cause can equally be argued by the defendant in pointing to the action of the plaintiff.
So can sole cause.
Well, sole cause, though, is purely a defensive issue. It is not a party neutral instruction.
Under a Lemos situation, it could be argued. You don't need to get to the comparison because the defendant's 100% negligent.
Well,
I mean,
again,
it could be there are circumstances that could be used by a party.
That again gets into argument and rather than into the instructions.
Why wouldn't the fairest thing to do be change the last sentence of the cause instruction and the sole cause instruction both to say there may be one cause, more than one cause, or no cause of an accident?
When that occurs, what has happened is that an unavoidable accident instruction has been given. That is the net effect of that particular approach. And that, again, is an inferential rebuttal issue and would basically confuse the jury. In conclusion, we do not believe, we do not see any distinction between Roper in the line of cases preceding Roper and the facts of this case. You had essentially the same result. You had conduct by a non-party. In Roper it was a pair. Here it was somebody not related, but still a non-party. And you had the jury diverted, the jury's attention diverted from what should have been product defect. Thank you.
The court is ready to hear arguments from respondents.
Mr. Ware will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court, I'm Lee Ware. My co-counsel is Paul Stallings. We represent the respondent, the Remington Arms Company, Inc. Mr. Stallings and I tried the case for Remington. We've come here to argue on Remington's behalf. I will, unless the court indicates otherwise, argue only one reply point, and that is the one to the effect that there was no error presented by the Court of Appeals holding that it was proper to instruct the jury on the sole cause instruction.
As to the other reply points, can you stand on your brief?
I'm sorry, sir?
If the court were to reach the other points, can you stand on what's in the brief?
Yes, I understand the whole case is before the court, but I'm not going to comment unless the court indicates it's interested in those other points, and we'd stand on the brief. Prior to talking about the reply point, I'd like to talk a little bit about some facts that are not emphasized in the petitioner's brief and facts that were emphasized by Mr. Stallings and I on behalf of Remington at trial. And then after that, I want to make a few responses to Mr. Cochran, then I'll close with arguing the reply points. There were essentially two sharply divided factual theories presented at trial with respect to how the accident happened. There was a theory presented by Mr. Cochran on behalf of Mr. Oschlager. Mr. Gdornak, the shooter, testified that he believed that the rifle would hold four rounds. He was incorrect in that belief. It would actually hold five, but that's what he thought. He testified at trial that he loaded three rounds into the magazine, which is the place in the part of the rifle where the ones that are not in the firing position are contained, at the campouts. On the stand, he testified that he got to the stand, the deer stand that is, and that he put one in the chamber. And at the time that he said he put one in the chamber, he made a gesture, which I interpreted, and so did my witness, Mr. Hutton, interpreted as being he added one to the chamber, not to the magazine. Later, his testimony was that all he did was operate the bolt and chamber one out of the magazine into the chamber. The rifle remained loaded all day. He unloaded it that evening when the hunting party was returning to Houston. He did it by putting it down on a bench and opening with the bolt up, putting his hand on the stock, and he was going to, he said, open the bolt, even though the safety was on, and he thought the safety was on, and even though he knew he couldn't open the bolt with the safety on. And as he touched it, that at that point in time, the rifle fired. If that theory is believed by the jury, there should be, found in the rifle when somebody finally does get to the rifle and check it, there should be found in the rifle one spent piece of brass from the fired round in the chamber, and there should be two live rounds in the magazine. Our theory at trial was presented primarily through the testimony of the man who unloaded the rifle, Deputy Reese, and the landowner, Mr. Noshka, who was present at the time that the rifle was unloaded that evening. In 1983, Daryl Dornack, the shooter, told Dr. Rao, the plaintiff's expert, that he loaded four rounds in the rifle at the stand. In evidence is Plaintiff's Exhibit 411, Dr. Rao's notes. And on Dr. Rao's notes, it reads, quote, loaded by DD, Daryl Dornack, four rounds in stand. Deputy Reese, when he checked the rifle, and he testified live at trial, under subpoena from us, when he checked the rifle, he said he found one spent piece of brass, one spent round, in the chamber, and no live rounds in the magazine. Mr. Noshka, who was present when Deputy Reese unloaded the rifle, said that there was one spent round, one hull, he called it, in the chamber, and no live rounds in the magazine. Mr. Dornack talked to Mr. Noshka the day after the accident when he went back to get his belongings. At that time, Mr. Noshka reports, Dornack said, I unloaded the rifle on one side of the table. I moved it to the other side of the table, and it fired because it had a round I didn't know about. Our position at trial was that during the day, Mr. Dornack had added one round or somehow got four rounds into the rifle. He had actually unloaded the rifle or thought he had unloaded the rifle when he took out three rounds. He left one round in there, not knowing it was there. He pulled the trigger and cocked the rifle before he was going to put it in the gun case. It fired and hit Mr. Oschlager. And that was the theory that we went to trial on. We also defended on there was no defect. The jury had a full development of the facts from the witnesses that we could find. The jury also got to see Mr. Dornack. Mr. Dornack himself testified as to what his habits with respect to gun handling safety were. Mr. Dornack is a man who said that he habitually carried loaded rifles in vehicles. He is a man who said that he habitually stored loaded rifles unattended in houses during the day. He is a man who said that he habitually relied upon his memory instead of looking into a rifle to see if it was actually cleared and fully and completely unloaded. Mr. Dornack, and I handed Mr. Dornack several rifles during the course of the trial, and if there were any way that I could get Dornack to come in here with a loaded rifle, and if y'all could watch him for about 30 seconds, you'd all be behind the marble up there, I promise you. There'd be no doubt about it. Those were the factual settings that set up the trial, and that is the factual setting that prompted me to request a sole cause instruction.
But what does the sole cause instruction add to the cause instruction standing alone?
The normal cause instruction?
Yes.
What it adds is it tells the jury that there is evidence that can be only one cause, that it's not a concurring causation case. That's what it adds.
But can't you argue that with just the cause instruction alone?
You can argue. You can argue it without
the instruction. Why should the judge comment on it one way or the other?
You can argue it without the judge commenting or instructing the jury on it.
So why should the judge give the instruction?
Because it's helpful to the jury. Because these are terms of art that are used for the jury, and they are told in the previous instruction that this is a case where there may be many causes. That's the normal instruction. And that in this particular case, the evidence, if it does raise it, it's appropriate for the judge to give a sole cause instruction because it focuses the jury's attention on that causation issue. It enables them to render a verdict, and that's the reason why.
Except for the fact that the jury is instructed there might be more than one cause, wouldn't it be better just to tell the jury that cause is what it is and leave it to argument whether there's one or more than one or what the circumstances are?
If there were going to be a change in the way that we define causation, the change that I would opt for and would say would be the fair change would be just to define causation, foreseeability and so forth in the case of proximate cause, cause and fact in the case of producing cause, and not add the plaintiff's instruction, the normal plaintiff's instruction that usually plaintiffs want, of there can be more than one cause. The reason why, Justice Heck, I would not say that your previous suggestion would be acceptable is because there are cases where sole cause is not raised by the evidence. So you shouldn't have you shouldn't say there may be one cause, many causes, or no cause. Because sometimes one cause is just flat not raised by the evidence, and it would be improper in that instance. I think, Justice Phillips, you are correct, sir, when you say that sole cause can sometimes be used by a plaintiff, because there are instances in which defendants, perhaps some of them even represented by me upon occasion, would say, really, this thing was caused by a lot of error from a lot of different people. And a plaintiff in that case, if he's got a target defendant, may very well want, and I have seen them request sole cause instructions.
In answering the question a minute ago, you used the words, the instruction focuses the jury's attention on the sole cause issue.
It focuses their attention on the causation issue.
Isn't that precisely what we didn't want the instructions to do, as we expressed in Roper, to focus the jury's attention on one particular phrase or one particular aspect of the defense or prosecution of the case?
In the Roper case, and in the line of cases that precede Roper, and I believe the case sees Roper as being an extension of the Flashman-Guadiano and Cord cases, just like Mr. Cochran does. In that case, the court, as it's done numerous times, says, don't take the jury's eye off of the ball, so to speak. Don't divert their attention from the issues that Turner says we want the jury to answer. And I think I understand that. This is not an instruction, though, where I've gone out and dreamed it up out of 402A from the comments and added it in. This is an instruction that focuses their attention on one of the issues. If Justice Spears, if that were the case, if we should not ever focus the jury's attention, then it seems to me like the trial court has, to some extent, abdicated the judicial function. And I would then say, if that's the case, then why should the judge ever even define causation if there's not to be any focusing of
the
attention?
The reason for Roper was that we don't want the trial judge to focus on the either side's theory of the case, but just simply take the question as is asked of them and let the parties argue sole cause and let the parties argue this, that, and the other.
The trial court, by necessity of submitting the plaintiff's questions, has focused their attention on that theory, those theories.
Do you disagree with the proposition that the holding of this court, the Court of Appeals here, is contrary to Roper?
Yes, sir, I do. And the reason why, and I'll go into that in some detail, because that is essentially the reply point that I wanted to argue. The reason that I say that is because the Roper opinion is an instance in which the issue is not raised by the evidence. In Roper, it was undisputed as to what the facts were. There was no guard on the discharge chute, and the little 3-year-old girl put her hand in the discharge chute when she was unattended or the lawnmower was unattended by the parents. In this instance, the facts are extremely different in the sense that there's a sharp contrast between their two totally different theories. In Roper, the second point, the evidence did not raise sole cause, because if the jury in Roper had found defect, the jury in Roper of necessity must have found that the absence of the discharge chute was at least a concurring cause. So it's a concurring cause case, and if it's a concurring cause case, it's not a case where you should appropriately submit sole cause. The third distinction with respect
to... Why isn't it true that the jury found a defect here?
The jury did not find a defect here.
But if they had...
If they had found defect here, in this instance, it's an intermittent defect. Sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. That's their theory. There wasn't any evidence setting up the five conditions, preconditions that have to take place before the trigger tricks. But if the jury found defect here, they were still free to believe that the defect wasn't present at the time that this accident happened, that this accident was absent causation from the defect because it was Gornack pulling the trigger when he thought he fully unloaded the rifle. But Justice Spears, the final thing with respect to the Roper opinion is exactly that. And that is that it is, or the Roper case, the facts of the Roper case, is that it is not an instance in which, the jury was free to find, if they find defect, to find that the absence of the chute did not participate in causing it. It of necessity had to have been a concurring cause. Also in Roper was the parental negligence, or the parental conduct that was in question. In a case where you argue third-party conduct, and the facts are undisputed, as they were in Roper, and if you give an inferential rebuttal issue of sole cause, the court has commented on the weight of the evidence, and it's done so improperly. A sole cause instruction being an inferential rebuttal type of issue is, by definition, evidentiary. You know, when we used to submit the issues, if you won a sole cause issue, special issue, you got a new trial. You did not get a judgment. It would not support a judgment. It's an evidentiary issue. And consequently, the Roper case gets to the right result. And the reason it gets to the right result is anytime there's an inferential rebuttal issue is submitted by instruction that is not raised by the evidence, the court, by definition, has commented upon the evidence improperly. What is prohibited in Texas historically is not commenting on the case. Texas courts have always been free to instruct the jury and comment on the case. What is prohibited is the improper comment on the weight of the evidence, which has been prohibited all along. Historically, when our courts submitted cases on special verdicts and submitted them on general charges, there are all kinds of instructions that were proper, even though there was still a statute back prior to 1913 that said you cannot comment upon the weight of the evidence. And I'm not sure I've been totally responsive, but I would distinguish Roper for those reasons. One, the facts in Roper were undisputed. Two, the evidence did not raise the issue. And three, at most in Roper, if they found defect, it would be a concurring cause. And this that's different because this is a case where they would not have to find concurring cause. That's the best job I can do on that, Judge.
Did he testify that he left the gun loaded and unattended all day long?
Yes, sir. All of the hunting party left their rifles loaded and unattended in the camphouse all day long.
He testified he had learned from his father, but was there any testimony as to how many times he had ever handled a Remington 700?
There was testimony as to his experience with bolt-action rifles, and he had previously hunted with his father's Model 700. But the rifle that he learned how to shoot with was a Model 94 Winchester. And the reason that he put it on the bench is because of the habit, of the concern that many people have is when you start taking the rounds out of a lever action, they fall to the floor and they might blow up or something. And you see people unload them on beds and things, and that's what Dornack was actually trying to do. His concern about uncocking it, I think, comes from the 94 because of the old belief that you have to, that you ought to uncock the lever action hammer so that it doesn't mess up the springs.
Given the fact that you recited here today, what was your theory of contributory negligence on the part of the plaintiff?
Mr. Oschlager,
being there,
Mr. Oschlager stepped in front of the rifle. If the testimony is that somebody is unloading a rifle and you can see clearly what they're doing, and that was the testimony, it's not a time to step in front of it. Now, I have to tell you, you don't have the argument in front of you, and I have to tell the court that there wasn't 2 seconds worth of argument made by us that Oschlager was actually contributory negligent. We tried the case on Mr. Dornack did it.
I mean, it kind of undercuts your insistence on necessity for sole proximate cause here when you were arguing two causes.
Arguing two causes? I think we do get to do that.
You're telling the jury there were two causes and they should pick one as the sole proximate cause.
I think we get to submit both theories.
But when we're talking about an instruction that has been disapproved of by this court on several occasions in certain contexts, we now have to look at the context when it's proper.
This court's never disapproved that instruction on sole cause.
In certain contexts, they have.
Only when the evidence doesn't raise it, as in the Roper opinion.
The argument you've made here about the trial judge analyzing when sole cause is proper and when it's not is perhaps somewhat subtle.
It is subtle.
For some trial judge. I mean, it's going to be very hard to put this in
a jury
charge.
It is subtle. And if this court's about to say we're not going to submit any inferential rebuttal issues anymore, I'm in trouble. Unless you only do it prospectively, which you haven't done to the detriment of a plaintiff in some time.
Well, I think it's fair to say we're looking for guidance. We're not about to do anything.
Let me tell you why I think that the trial judge can handle it, Your Honor, if you will. First of all, Rule 277 says I get an instruction on inferential rebuttal issues. Secondly, there are 2 Supreme Court cases, Hopkins, to the extent that it's not overruled, and Duncan did not overrule Hopkins in this respect, and Signal Oil say that I get sole cause in a products case. Third, the sole cause instruction has been submitted since the 1890s, and it is helpful to the jury because it focuses their attention upon the causation issue that they have to answer. Fourth, the pleadings raise it. Fifth, the evidence raises it. Sixth, it exists in Volume 1 and Volume 2 of the pattern jury charge. Seventh, Roper does not say expressly that I never get an instruction on sole cause. And eighth, I'm probably going to get sued if I don't request it and lose the case. And under those circumstances, I'm going to request it, and I'm going to try real hard to get Judge Powell or any other judge to give it to me.
But the legal commentary I read in the state of Texas says almost unanimously, in fact, I don't know of any to the contrary, that sole cause is a defense. Is it really a defense, or is it just an argument that there is no cause in this case?
It's a real defense. In Hodges, it's explained in his book on special issues. It's a real defense. What it is negatives a portion of the prima facie case of the plaintiff, the causation portion, and therefore it is a true defense. It is not an affirmative defense that reduces the recovery of the plaintiff once they find defect in causation.
Well, how is it a defense other than to say the plaintiff has not proved his case? The plaintiff has not proved cause. Because he says this caused it, and in fact it didn't.
In fact, something else did. You see, the way that this differs from the usual, the way that a sole cause case differs in the way it's tried from the usual case, in most cases, if you're going to argue causation, most cases you don't argue causation that much because if they stick you on liability, you're already there in causation. But when you argue it, you can take the option of, my product didn't cause it. When you argue sole cause, you say, not only did my product not cause it, but I can really explain to you how it did happen. You've got a totally alternative theory.
But you have that theory with or without a sole cause instruction, with or without any sole cause law.
Yes, sir. You did.
See, what bothers me about this defense, and I understand your analysis, it's a true defense, but it's already there in the language of the chart. By the words maybe, can, that they're in the proximate cause instruction. And you have the tools there to make that argument to the jury. Whereas in a situation of waiver, say, in Island Recreation, not to go over flog dead horses, but there you have a harder time pointing to anything in the charge.
All of the inferential rebuttal issues are left over from the inferential rebuttal submissions that used to be made. And the theory was then, and I think still should be, that I may be a defendant in a products case, but at some point in time, I still get an affirmative presentation in the charge of my theory. It does not suffice psychologically to help me, and does not suffice to help me with the jury, to just ask the plaintiff's questions. At some point in time, even a defendant is entitled to get an affirmative presentation of his theory.
That's what I said in my dissenting opinion in Island Recreation.
Yes, sir, it is.
Entitled to his issues.
Yes, sir.
But this is not a case where it's an affirmative defense. Sole cause is not an affirmative defense. It's an inferential rebuttal.
And that's the reason why I did not submit issues. I requested only the instruction.
But should you give inferential rebuttals in instructions?
Yes, sir, I think you should, because that's the only thing a defendant has for his part. That's the only way that the defendant gets anything in the charge. Out of this whole charge, I get one issue on contributory negligence, which I know they're not going to answer against the guy, and I get one sentence in sole cause. Now, I got two. And I'm pretty short on time, and I'll address that for just a second and then get back to that, Judge. This is not a pure products liability case. Special issue number 12 asks, was Remington Arms grossly negligent? And Mr. Cochran argued for $16 million in gross negligence, punitive damages. Mr. Cochran, when he submitted, was Remington Arms Inc. grossly negligent, proximately causing the occurrence in question, he did not define negligence, and he did not define proximate cause. And I wanted a definition of negligence, and I wanted a definition of proximate cause, because this is not a product liability issue. And what the court did was, he grabbed off an issue defining proximate cause that had a sole proximate cause instruction on it that had been attached to some other issue, and he put it in the charge. And nobody ever said, you got two of them in there. And I didn't know until we briefed it that I had two of them in there. Okay, but I don't think there's any harm presented by this, because the term proximate cause is used in the gross negligence issue, and that's why there are two. I'm not going to submit sole proximate cause on my contrib issue. The reason I wanted the second one was because of the gross negligence issue. And secondly, both of those come straight out of the pattern jury charge, and it's done two different ways. In volume one, they do sole proximate cause. In volume three, on product liability, they do sole cause. And I think that the job can be done with just one in this case, but that's not where we got to. And I don't think that the addition of one more caused this case to come out the way it did. The reason that the man got zero damages on a lot of the things that he got zero damages on had to do with a jury not wanting to give him anything because they did not believe the product was defective.
Is it better for the judge in the charge to instruct the jury on theories of both sides? In other words, there may be more than one cause, but there may only be one cause. Or is it better for the charge to be silent on that subject?
I think that the judicial function historically has been, and I think it should remain, that the judge instructs the jury affirmatively on both sides. And I believe that, if I may take just a second of the court's time, I understand that the court wants personal injury cases tried in the way in which the charges have been come out of the cases. But sole cause was not in the Turner case, and I don't think anybody says that the Turner case means that we can never do anything. There are nine of y'all and about 40,000 of us. And every once in a while, it may be that one of us lawyers will come up with a good idea on something that might help a jury resolve a difficult fact question or resolve a difficult special issue that they've been asked. And when that happens, I would hope that the court would not be so imperial as to say that you don't need our help on that. And I would hope that the trial judge would be free, when somebody does come up with a good idea, to give it a try. It is wrong to create a double standard once again and say on personal injury product design cases you can never vary from what we did in Turner. That's wrong, because that's not the way this court is letting commercial cases be submitted. In commercial cases, they get all kinds of comments, all kinds of instructions, and it's wrong to say, you product defendant, you don't get anything in the charge that's yours, whereas if you're a commercial defendant, you can ask and get a lot of things, like an Island Recreation, if they've been asked for, in the charge. And that's incorrect, in my judgment. This instruction focuses the jury's attention on my theory. I am a defendant, but I'm entitled to an affirmative submission It does not comment on the weight in the sense that it nudges the jury to think about insurance, as in Fleischman and Guadagnino. It does not take their eye off the ball because it talks about contributory negligence in a case where contrib is not a defense. It talks about a theory that I pleaded and proved. It talks about a theory that defendants have been getting in, by way of instruction since 1973 and used to get by submission since 1890. This is not where Stallings out work trying to work over some plaintiff on the charge. I didn't dream this up there. It comes out of the pattern jury charge.
Have you had any opportunity to look into other states that are that have a longer history with a simplified general charge to see if sole proximate cause is still
no, sir, I'm not.
Viable around the nation?
I have not. I'm sorry, I have not looked into that.
You don't know anything about what the national treatises say about it?
I do know that Mr. Sales and Mr. Edgar are wrong in their treatise when they describe the nature of sole cause. Sole cause doesn't have anything to do with negligence. The conduct that's in question can be innocent, it can be intentional, it can be negligent, but it does not require negligence. And that's the only commentary I know of the sole cause except for what comes out of Hodges and what comes out of the Green Texas procedure book, McDonald. And those are the ones I'm familiar with, and I'm just sorry I haven't looked elsewhere.
I apologize for having to ask you to repeat this, but tell me again why sole proximate cause is not an inferential rebuttal issue.
It is an inferential rebuttal issue. And
you're just saying it's been allowed and ought to be continued.
If I've indicated that I thought otherwise, I misspoke.
I'm sorry.
It is an inferential rebuttal issue, Your Honor. And my position has to be, since I submitted one, has to be that I should be allowed to submit it in the future.
Well, is there any case where this court has said inferential rebuttal should not be submitted by instruction if it's legitimately raised other than Island Recreation if you don't think that was a waiver of a waiver?
I don't want to get into Island Recreational, but there is no case other than Island Recreational that even suggests that if you plead it and raise it by the evidence that you don't get it, if it's an inferential rebuttal issue. I only know of three. Sole cause, unavoidable accident of which act of God is a specie, and intervening cause to an independent cause.
If we file Island Recreation, you won't get anything.
Your Honor is well aware of the fact that I agree with Your Honor on Island Recreation. If trial courts are to be allowed to experiment on how broad they can be in their submission, then every once in a while they ought to be allowed to do something with respect to trying to help the jury with their instructions. And I know the court doesn't want, I know my time's expired, I know the court doesn't want to get in a position where you have to reverse a lot of cases because of the charge. And I'm not suggesting that you turn us loose and let us go out and do anything we want to on personal injury cases on the charge. I'm just saying that if the evidence raises it and you plead it and it's recognized and it's been defined by the court, that's an instance. All I need to do is carry that to get remedy out of it, and that's all I'm asking the court to do.
But if we agree with you, won't we wind up putting all these inferential rebuttal instructions, we'll get assumption of the risk and all these other things back in the charge again, won't we?
Justice Ray, I would not for a second change the Duncan opinion. That's the only good thing. That's one of the best things that happened to my clients. And I would not for a second say that we ought to go back to all of those other independent defenses. I agree with Mr. Cochran that there's one way to submit the defensive matter in a product liability case, and that's the way it's set out in Duncan. I have no trouble with Duncan. Well-written case. There's some problems with Keene versus Ashot. I understand that you all have those problems, but you don't have to cross those problems in my case. And I'm not suggesting that we go back to the days where lawyers are allowed to proliferate instructions for the charge. That's not the position I'm taking. I'm taking the position that a recognized one that's been in existence and has been approved by this court, that I, as a defendant, get an affirmative instruction, and the fact of being a defendant aside.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Yeah, please, court.
May it please the court. I'll keep my rebuttal very brief. The question asked by Justice Ray at the end of Mr. Ware's presentation highlights the concern in this case. That is that if the sole charge instruction is approved in this case, then the next one that comes along will be unavoidable accident. The next one after that will be intervening cause. The next one after that will be some other species of an inferential rebuttal issue. The problem is highlighted by Chief Justice Pope in the Montez decision when he concluded saying that history teaches that broad issues and accepted definitions suffice and that a workable jury system demands strict adherence to simplicity in charges. Prior to that, he had stated that for every thrust by the plaintiff for an instruction or an issue becomes a parry by the defendant. And that is the way lawsuits are tried. It's the way our system works. It's appropriate in evidence. It's appropriate in examination. It's appropriate in argument. It is not appropriate in the jury's charge.
Let me ask you what I asked the respondent. If the two choices were to say something both about many causes and about sole cause, or, on the other hand, to say nothing about either one of them, in your view, which would be better in the charge?
The latter. Say nothing about either one. I believe that the court is on the right path as it set about beginning with Mobil Chemical Company against Bell in fashioning a system of submission of the jury of jury issues in a simplified, clear, concise manner without a proliferation of either instructions or issues. And I, in all honesty, I think there's something to be said for a general charge approach, provided it is not weighted down with a proliferation of instructions. And I have a lot of faith in our jury system, and I think juries generally reach right results in cases that are properly presented and adequately tried and prepared. I think they have a lot of sense. And I think that as we weight down what juries can do with instructions such as this or with the old issues that we used to use, that we do our jury system a disservice. We do our jury members a disservice.
How do you get? I agree with what you say, but to tell me why, if this were error to give these instructions, that it was harmful error, that probably did cause the rendition of an improper judgment.
It was harmful error because in the process of focusing the jury's attention on the defendant's defense, it elevated that defense to the point to where the effect on the jury, and I think Mr. Ware is correct, this jury just didn't want to give the plaintiff anything.
That's pretty obvious.
That is pretty obvious. This jury bought their defense. It bought the theory that Daryl Dornack was a terrible gun handler and that he was so careless that he didn't even know how many rounds were in that rifle and that he pulled the trigger.
My question assumes that.
Certainly.
Right.
And by doing that, then, the harmful error occurs because it builds that. It builds in the jury's mind that this is what happened. It, in effect, has the court telling the jury, folks, I'm the judge up here, and I'm focusing you on this part of the case. That's the evil of the judge commenting on the weight of the evidence. Because jurors pay attention to judges. They respect them. And that's the harmful error. And the harm is evidenced by the damage instruction, the damage issues, the answers to the damage issues. The finding of no pain when a man's leg is blown off, which is ludicrous. In conclusion,
have you thought about my question, under your argument, would sole cause ever be a proper instruction?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. In a design defect case, which is what we have here, I don't believe it is a proper instruction.
Well, I guess, I find it very hard to trace through Roper and Duncan and come out with the arguments in both the briefs about how those laws may have changed the intent the court's been at that you're tracing today, starting all the way from Mobil Chemical versus Bell. But can you come up with it? Let's just take a simple negligence. Any kind of case that merely involves negligence. Any situation where, given the arguments you've made today, we should retain a concept that you can instruct on this particular defense.
I think the argument to support a sole cause defense in a pure negligence case is probably a little stronger than in a product liability case, but as a policy matter, no, I do not believe it should be given. I cannot conceive of a case if we're going to follow.
But you recognize it's a defense in this case.
I recognize that it's a position that can be argued, and it's a position that can be argued and evidence presented on in any case, negligence or strict liability.
Is this a defense that has to be pled under Rule 93?
As an inferential rebuttal issue, as an inferential rebuttal question, I think the defendants can always argue that the plaintiff has failed to prove an element of his cause of action, causation being one of those elements. And I think he could certainly argue that the reason he hasn't proved it is because so-and-so out here is the true cause. I doubt that I could prevent on objection that I could prevent that argument being presented.
Do an unavoidable accident and intervening cause have to be pled under Rule 93? Are they different, or would they fall in the same category?
I would presume they would fall in the same category. They all go to the causation issue. If appropriate, and if the court would agree, some of the questions that have been raised today would be appropriately responded to in a post-submission brief, and I would like to ask permission of the court.
How long would you like?
A short time, 10 days.
10 days? 10 days to respond?
I have probably no remedy case next week, and I was hoping that the court would roll the bench so I'd know what to do.
If you desire to do this, would you just take a quick look through the national treatises, see what other states, and I think we are moving to a submission system, it's closer to what other states have, if any other jurisdictions would face this problem?
Certainly will, Your Honor.
Then give him another shot at it.
He's got 10 days.
Was there anything that Dornak did that was correct in the handling of that rifle?
Well, he may have held it up as he was walking into the room. He was not the best gun handler. I made no effort to defend Dornak. The only issue that I was looking at with Mr. Dornak was whether he was a truthful person when he said he didn't touch the trigger. And on that issue, I believed him to be a truthful person. As to his gun handling ability, I certainly would not defend it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court will now take another brief discussion.